Well, good morning. I ask you to find a Bible this morning open to the book of 2 Corinthians chapter 13. 2 Corinthians chapter 13. That's not a passage you hear very often, is it? Last chapter of one of Paul's least read letters, I think, at least in my experience. 2 Corinthians chapter 13. That's where we're going to be, or take our thoughts from a line we find in a verse there this morning. And while you're settling into finding 2 Corinthians 13, let me just do a quick bit of housekeeping here. I think many of you know by now, we've had a couple of young men working with David and I as summer interns this summer. Hunter Allen's sitting there next to David and Heidi, and Joel Purcell's over here next to the Lopez's. And a couple of fine young men, they're in the middle of their college careers and thinking about preaching and have been working with us this summer. And normally, you know, we would have had a lot more interaction with them in a typical summer because we would have been together more and doing more and worshiping together more. And so many of you may not have had as much of an opportunity to meet them or get to know them, but especially because we're having to split the church services, you don't always get to hear them preach. Both those young men shared the last service here, the 9 o'clock service, earlier this morning. And so y'all in this service didn't get a chance to hear them. But if you go to our Bible class page, the wonderful page that our technology guys have built for us, besides, you know, usually, I know how this works, right? You're looking for class on Wednesday night or Sunday afternoon. You wait until the last minute, so you're just scrolling to get to where you need to be real quick. And sometimes you miss some of the other stuff on there. One of the other things on that page is links to the videos of most of our recent Sunday services. So you can not just hear some of these sermons online, but see those sermons as well. The video links are on that same Bible class page. And I would encourage those of us in this service this morning, if you get a chance sometime this week, I really would encourage you to go back and listen to Hunter and Joel and the fine work that they did this morning as well. I know that'd be encouraging to them, and then you can say a good word to them, encouraging them and their interest and learning how to work and serve God and God's people in this way. It's been good to have them with us this summer, but again, because of our circumstance, we're not all getting to interact with them to the degree we would have liked. But do listen to that if you get a chance, and we'll have a little bit more opportunity, I think, to hear from them on Sundays before the summer's over. But again, splitting our service, it doesn't always, not everybody gets to hear everybody every time. So, all right, got your Bible? 2 Corinthians chapter 13, one verse and really one line from that verse this morning catches my attention. I want to think with you about this for just a few minutes this morning. 2 Corinthians 13 and verse 5, the apostle writes this. He says, "Test yourselves to see if you are in the faith. Examine yourselves. Or do you not recognize this about yourselves, that Jesus Christ is in you, unless you indeed fail the test?" Let me work backwards real quick. Last part of that verse, what he's getting at is, as you examine yourself, you ought to see the effects of having Jesus in your life. You ought to see his influence on how you think and what you want and what you desire and how you live, how you act. It ought to come out in what you say and what you do. And so when you test yourself, you ought to be able to see Christ in you. But the issue is this, and this is where we really are at this morning. It's that first line, it's that first sentence with a semicolon there that emphasizes at the beginning and the end, test yourselves, examine yourselves. Apostle is emphatic about this. Twice in the course of just a few words, Paul encourages those Corinthian Christians to look closely at themselves and to test themselves, to try themselves, to look discerningly at themselves, to scrutinize themselves, and to see if they really are the real deal, if they really are Christians, if they look Christ-like, if the implications of what they confess are coming out of their conduct, to put themselves on the scale, to look in the mirror and get an objective, honest assessment of who they really are. Oh, how we need that admonition in our shallow and superficial times. You know, even the pagans have, over the course of human history and over the centuries and millennia, even the pagans have recognized the need of honest self-awareness over time. Know thyself was the famous inscription over the court of the Temple of Apollo at Delphi in ancient Greece. Even the ancients recognized the importance of living a healthy human life was to do the hard work of not just looking at others and correcting them, but looking at ourselves and honestly learning to see the truth about who and what we really are. Problem is, we lived a very superficial age. If this has always been a human struggle, such that even the ancient Greeks would remind themselves, you need to know yourself. You need to know who and what you really are. If even the ancient pagans recognized that that's the perennial challenge, oh, how much more in an age of social media and reality television do we need to be reminded of what it means to know yourself. We live in a made-for-TV age, right? We have young people, and maybe you're one of those young people this morning who you want to be the next viral thing on the internet, right? And so you're always looking for that viral moment. You're making your TikTok. You're making your little Facebook clip. You're trying to create the next meme, something to go viral. And so, in a sense, rather than being self-aware, we're others-aware and circumstance-aware, and we're looking for an image. We're looking to create an image. We're looking to cultivate an image. We live in a made-for-TV, made-for-YouTube age, where what we call reality TV, it's hard to believe we've had that for 20 years now, but that's about right. Reality TV, boy, was that a symptom that told us where we were headed, and we didn't realize it fully at the time. We just thought Survivor was kind of cool initially before it got kind of raunchy. Reality TV for 2 decades now has acculturated us to the idea of putting on an image, of manipulating reality. Y'all realize reality TV is not real. It's still edited. They still only show you what they want you to see so that you think this person's the good person, that person's the bad person, that this is the villain, that that's the hero. And you realize it's still all fake, right? Reality TV is not real. But boy, is that the essence of our age, where everything is cultivated, the idea of putting on an image, manipulating reality to fit our expectations, our narrative, our desires, our whims. We're going to force life to go according to the storyline we want. And boy, have we raised a generation or two now who have a hard time accepting the fact that life doesn't always turn out like you planned, that things happen. You get cancer, you lose your job, somebody breaks your heart. That you don't have that kind of control. You can't just edit life and call it real. So it goes in our time and our place. We live distracted lives that are typically too busy to allow the quiet, the stillness, and the time necessary for honest self-evaluation. Because you know what? Testing yourself, knowing yourself, examining yourself, that takes time. You don't do that in 30 seconds. You don't do that in 30 seconds. In a world in which everything is about putting on appearance, not substance, when it's about acquaintances rather than relationships, when it's about posturing rather than producing something, we are so busy that to sit in silence for 60 seconds would be almost an unbearable burden. I mean, let's be honest, we all do this, right? We talk about this from time to time. I do it too. You're in the grocery store line. At least when we used to go to the grocery store, we weren't socially distancing. You go to the grocery store line, and it was long, and you get bored. And so what would you do if you had to wait 30 or even 60 seconds? You reach for your phone, and you start swiping, right? No waste of space. You could have prayed. You could have meditated upon a passage. You could have opened up your Bible program on your phone, but let's be honest, that's not what we did. We need to add a couple Facebook notifications we need to check on anyways, and Twitter's dinging. And I need to, actually, this is a very Instagrammable moment. Let me take a picture of me stuck in line and post my outrage at the fact that I'm going to have to wait 2 minutes in the richest country in the world to check out. We're too busy and we're too distracted to be quiet, to be still, and to honestly look at ourselves. And to be honest, if we were honest with ourselves about this, we'd probably welcome any excuse to avoid that appointment with ourselves. Because we'd have to start seeing some things and thinking about some things and changing some things and confessing some things and apologizing for some things that we don't want to do. And so it goes in our time and our place. I would love for a politician somewhere, anywhere, sometime to just get up and say, you know what, I was wrong, made the wrong call, I'm sorry. I'd vote for that person. That might be somebody I could actually believe in and trust. In politics, we spin. In religion, we excuse. In school, we lower our academic standards. In families, we divorce. In all of this, we never face who and what we are. And we never ponder the possibility that maybe the problem is not them out there, the problem is me. We have been trained in our age to be fakes.
to be ready for to be camera ready, to refuse to look in the mirror and accept its verdict. We always put our thumb on the scale rather than risk the verdict that Belshazzar got with the handwriting on the wall, Mene, Mene, Tekel, Upharsin. You have been weighed was part of that message. And we put our thumbs on the scale and disagree with what God would say about us all too often. Again, the ancients knew what a wrestling match this was, the struggle with ourselves. It said that Diogenes the Cynic, one of the ancient Greek philosophers, would walk around in daytime the streets of his ancient Greek city with a lamp, and people would ask him, what are you doing? And he'd say, I'm looking for an honest man. And that was the whole point of his thought exercise, to provoke his fellow citizens to recognize we are not honest with each other. We are not living honestly with ourselves. And so what I want to do very quickly in the final few minutes I've got with you this morning is I want to take this language that Paul has given to us of testing ourselves, of examining ourselves, and I want to look at three areas very quickly, if I can. Three areas in which we need to be examining ourselves. The list could be as long as there are people in this room. We all have different areas and things that we wrestle with. But I want to hit three areas that I think are common and that I think are painful and therefore often overlooked or under-evaluated in our own self-examination. Let me give you these three things, these three ideas, these three words, and then we'll be through for our time together this morning. Number one, when it comes to examining ourselves, number one, let's examine our friendships. Our friendships. Can we be honest with ourselves about this morning, as long as we're talking about being honest with ourselves? Can we be honest with ourselves that the reality is that we are greatly influenced by the people we allow into our lives, by the friendships that we choose and that we maintain and that we value, that we are greatly influenced by the people in our lives? Our associations and our friendships leave an indelible mark over the long haul on our personality and our character. Sometimes we see that in certain relationships. Sometimes we see that with our parents, for instance. I remember when I was in my 20s and I began to remember that I was signing a document. It was what it was. I was in probably my late 20s and I was signing a document and it hit me one day. My signature looks just like my dad's. See, kids, you used to have to sign something when you used a credit card. You didn't just put your chip in. And so I grew up for years. And by the way, kids, there was that magnetic strip. It was always on there, but there was cutting-edge technology back in the day. Nobody used it. They put your card in the thing. And you remember how your numbers used to be raised on your credit card? And it was kind of cool. And then I watched my dad sign, you know, everything. And again, there was no pay at the pump. You go in the gas station, you went and you paid for it, even if you're using your credit card. Because the guy in there had to, run his little thing over it. I miss that sound sometimes. All those years, forget what he's taught me, forget what he's told me. All those years watching him sign credit card slip after credit card slip after credit card slip, and one day it hits me in my late 20s, I'm a grown man on my own, married with my own mortgage. And it hits me, I sign just like my signature looks like his. Folks, we absorb the people in our lives, whether we know it or not. If that can be true of a signature, how much more can that be true of values and virtues and vices? Where we learn to be comfortable with sin because everybody else around us that we choose to stay in contact with is doing something. I tell you, that's one of the best basic ways sin spreads. It's not because we intentionally choose it. It's because we stay in the company of it. And our consciences are seared and our standards are lowered and our eyes are blinded. It's just like when you stare at a bright light too long. Can you see what's going on around you very well anymore? You ever go to the eye doctor? Sometimes they put the eye drops in your eyes. You remember? They dilate you and then you walk out. You remember? You walk out after. Yeah. And what happens? You can't see anything. Then you get in the car and you drive home. Oh, don't judge me. You've done it too. But you can't see because it's affected your vision. And now the bright light changes. Or have you ever been going down a dark road, you're traveling and you're going down a dark road, and those headlights of that one car that you haven't seen in forever are coming towards you, and he's got his high beams on and you got your high beams on because you're out in the middle of nowhere. And those high beams, as you get closer, and because the guy's got a late model year car, and so it's not like some sort of LED super technology, so it's extra powerful, and it blinds you. And as soon as he passes, what happens? You ever had this? It's scary. You can't find the shoulder of the road. You can't find the center line anymore because it takes about 10 seconds for your eyes to readjust. You ever had that happen? I've had that happen. That's scary. That's what happens, folks, spiritually speaking, when we allow certain kinds of companionships and friendships and relationships in our lives. It blinds our eyes to spiritual truth. Now listen, I know some of you are sitting there saying, yes, Jeff, I hear what you're saying, but listen, didn't Jesus hang out with the tax collectors and sinners? Wasn't Jesus going where the sinners were? Because that's where you got to go if you're going to save people and do evangelism and reach out with them. And I say, yes, that's exactly true. We're not talking about treating those who are not Christians as though they are some sort of lepers and, we have to walk on the other side of the street and yell, unclean, unclean, when they come near. That's not what we're talking about either. But let's be honest about something. Sometimes what happens is when we look at Jesus and we say, but Jesus ate with the tax collectors and sinners, we mistake the fact that he reached out to the tax collectors and sinners. He hung out with the disciples. And there's a world of difference. There's a world of difference. He wasn't with the tax collectors and sinners because he wanted to be like them. He went there to talk to them. Have you ever noticed every meal Jesus had with tax collectors and sinners got awkward? And there's a reason for that. Because eventually, at some point, someone asked him a question and he told them the truth. Or he noticed something, couldn't stay silent, and brought it up. And every time Jesus is hanging out with the tax collectors and sinners, it gets awkward. He reached out to the tax collectors and sinners. He hung out with the disciples. Those are the guys he hung out with around the campfire at night in the Galilean hillside. Those are the guys he literally at one point says, no longer are you strangers, you are friends. I call you friends. These are my friends. People who share the same values. People who are trying to do the same types of things. People who worship the same God. And so there's a challenge for us, folks. We've got to get real. We've got to get real about the fact that sometimes we allow relationships in our lives that are going to ultimately pull us from where we need to be and what we need to be. Christians, as one person put it one time, Christians will not make companions of those who would divert their allegiance away from the kingdom of God. We might be able to understand why so many people in our social circles throw themselves into their careers or their hobbies or some secular cause or mission that's got their passion. It's because they have no other focus, no other reason for living, nothing else to focus their time and their energy and their talents and their resources and their money on. But for Christians, we always have something higher to live for. It's called Jesus and his kingdom. And therefore, we're going to do different things and prioritize different things to put our time and our talent and our money in different places. And so at the end of the day, we've got to understand the importance of examining our friendships. Seek his kingdom first and his righteousness, and all these things will be added unto you. It's one thing to spend some spare moments playing golf with a casual friend or doing some gardening work with a neighbor. But the hearts of God's people yearn to spend as much time as possible with those who share their faith, who share their love, who share their values. Be careful who you call a friend when they probably should just be an acquaintance. Because too often, folks, and let's be honest, too often it's the folks in the church who are our acquaintances and the people in the world who are our friends. And we need to think about that and think about who's influencing who when that's the truth. Number two, when it comes to examining ourselves. Number two, let's examine ourselves when it comes to correction. Listen, it is hard to admit that we were the ones who are wrong. We were the ones who made the mistake. We're the ones who need to change what we're doing and how we are doing it. It's hard enough to do that when you come to that realization on yourself. It's even harder to do that when someone else has pointed it out to you. It's hard enough when we recognize in ourselves that we made a mistake. But what is it about us that when someone else points out, you've made a mistake, this is wrong, you need to change, you need to do differently, this is not going to end well for you or your family or your brethren. Why is it that it's so hard to accept that? Well, listen, we know it's hard. You know why we know it's hard? Because in our culture, nobody's ever wrong anymore. That's how hard it is. In our culture, as a people, we decided to just kind of define away people making mistakes. Nobody ever has to apologize for anything anymore, it seems like. It's hard enough to admit our own failures to change course. It's even harder when someone else points it out. And so what we have done collectively when confronted with wrongdoing is what we have learned to do in our country, in our culture, is to blame the other person. It's their problem. Rather than looking at ourselves biblically, we hold them biblically accountable. Judge not, lest you be judged, which is one of the most abused and taken out of context verses in all of Scripture, I am convinced, in our age, because Jesus was not forbidding judging. He was forbidding hypocritical judging. If anything, he was commanding the right kind of judging if you read that whole context. We absolutely hold each other accountable and correct each other. It's just I shouldn't be talking to you about your cheating on your wife before I fix the fact that I'm cheating on mine. If you catch my drift. That's what Jesus said. You got to stop that. Don't hold others to standards that you yourself don't live by. Can you imagine how very different the New Testament story would have gone if the disciples had been defensive? If the disciples had refused to take correction. You realize when you read through Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, have you noticed it seems like those poor guys, at least when it comes to Jesus, they can't get anything right? Jesus is always nudging them and correcting them and challenging them and rebuking them sometimes. Let's just take one of the 12 in particular. Let's take Peter. Ah, you know where this is going now, don't you? Peter was always the first to ask. He was always that guy. You ever had that guy in a meeting or a class, those of you who are younger at school still, you ever had that guy in the meeting or class? You love him because he asks the foolish stuff so you don't have to. You were thinking it, but you know because John's in the meeting, John's going to be the one to take the fall for the rest of us. And the best part is John hasn't even figured it out yet. That was Peter. None of the other disciples are getting it either. None of the other disciples are paragons of virtue and wisdom and discernment and insight over who Jesus of Nazareth is. But Peter was the guy who would always be the first to speak up and ask the question and therefore get blasted by the teacher. Peter was the guy who, in Matthew chapter 14, when he sees Jesus walking on the water, says, Lord, if it's you, command me to come out. And Jesus tells him to come out. And you remember the story. Rather than being able to walk on the water, what happens when Peter sees the wind and the waves? He sinks. Listen, in our day and age, you know what an adept corporate trainer would do at that point would be to affirm Peter's courage for trying. Right? That's not what Jesus does. What does Jesus do in that story? Oh, you of little faith, why did you doubt? What a different way of living in the world, isn't it? What a different way of living in the world. What Jesus does is not politically correct and not according to HR policy. He speaks the truth. He corrects Peter. Peter, yeah, you had courage to get out of the boat. That's great. But let's talk about the larger issue this failed exercise reveals. You're not there yet spiritually. You don't believe in me strongly enough yet. If these wind and these waves can rock your boat, so to speak, pardon the pun, then listen, the stuff that's coming down the road here in the coming months and years of this ministry, you're going to have a harder time hanging on then if you don't have faith now. Peter, you need to be stronger. It's not that I want to discourage you, but I need to tell you the truth about who you are and where you're at and what you need to survive long term. You know why the military is one of the last bastions of sanity and reality when it comes to training and boot camp? Because that's one of the few spheres in life where it is literally life or death. We don't care about your feelings. We care about whether you know this and understand this and get this right. Because if you don't, you're going to die and you may get your guy next to you killed too. And folks, we've got to recover that spiritually speaking, when it comes to the issue of correction and being pushed back on and challenged by the elders or by the preachers or by older mature members or by a friend who sees in us things that we do not see in ourselves, we've got to get over our hurt feelings and recognize it is life or death spiritually speaking. The reason the Marines aren't worried about whether you got a smiley sticker or a gold star today is because it is life or death when they go live, when they go into the field. And your feelings don't matter because Al-Qaeda or ISIS or any other enemy that we're facing, they don't care about your feelings. They're trying to kill you. And Satan, folks, is still trying to kill us. And so when it comes to the spiritual realm, we need to treat this like boot camp. Listen, I'm not saying this means open season. Don't worry about people's feelings. Just say it rather than think it. Don't misunderstand me this morning. There are proverbs about how a gentle word turns away wrath. And as Randy preached to us about so recently last month, about how the right word at the right time in the right way is a mark of wisdom. But folks, I think sometimes in our culture, we have gone too far to the opposite extreme where we do not want to correct each other, or we especially don't want to receive correction in the growing worldliness that we are liable to in this time. Because we've learned in the culture to never hurt anybody's feelings, to never give offense. And we've learned in the culture on the flip side, on the receiving end, we've learned to be defensive and blame others. Well, that's just your problem. That's how you see it. I will tell you, on those landing boats on D-Day, if one soldier saw another soldier as they're floating towards the shores of Normandy, saw a piece of equipment not loaded, a helmet not strapped down, piece of armor or camouflage not where it needs to be, somebody's left behind their extra ammunition, don't you think they were talking about that and dealing with that, and nobody says, you know, I'm so tired, Sergeant, of you getting on to me all the time. No, it was life and death. We thank the person who told us about our vulnerability before that gate drops and it goes live. When it comes to examining ourselves, we need to ask ourselves honestly, am I correctable? Am I correctable? Because I will tell you what I have learned in the culture and age that we have lived and in the work that I do, and I've seen it in myself as well for that matter, because I think it's a common human feeling. What all too often happens when we get close to something that somebody really needs spiritually, they get either really angry or really sad. And the emotions win, and the truth is not spoken. And sometimes maybe even spiritual death is at risk, because we could not risk the relationship to tell the truth about what's going on. But we need to examine ourselves. Am I the type of person that everybody dreads bringing something up to? Because I'm going to get really, really angry, really, really upset. We've learned that from the culture. That's not the attitude of the disciples. Again, can you imagine Peter, who, you know, from the time he gets out of the boat to the time that Jesus calls him Satan? I mean, listen, he got it half right. You are the Christ, the Son of God. But then when Peter turns around and says, you're not going to go to Jerusalem and die, now Jesus gets all jumpy on him and, get behind me, Satan. Or then there was a time Peter says, I'm not going to deny you, and rather than Jesus encouraging him, you know what, Peter, good for you. You hold on to that attitude, Peter. What does Jesus say? Oh, I'm going to tell you, before the morning comes, you're going to deny me three times before that rooster crows. What about later on in his apostolic ministry? We all know the story. In Antioch, when Peter won't eat with the Gentiles, and here comes Paul confronting him to the faith. Can you imagine how much different the New Testament story would be if Peter had the attitude of too many folks today? How dare you tell me that? I come here for encouragement. I've had a hard week. I'm here to feel better. When it comes to examining ourselves, we need to ask ourselves honestly, am I a correctable person? Or am I the person that the elders or the preachers or just members in the pew who know something about how we're living dread having to talk to because of how I'm going to react? Number three, quickly and finally this morning, one last thing. Let's examine ourselves with respect to our brethren. In some sense, as I alluded to that at the very beginning, when I talked about friendships, how it's very tragic that too often for too many of us, our acquaintances are the folks in the church and our friends are the folks in the world, and we need to flip that. But as long as we're talking about our relationships in the church, let's talk about this. And I'm in 1 Corinthians 6 this morning as kind of a way to begin to wrap this up. And something to see and something to think about. Let's think for a moment. Let's examine ourselves about how we treat our brethren. About how we treat each other sometimes. Listen, one of the things that breaks my heart sometimes is when a sad or a struggling or a hurting member confides in me in a one-on-one conversation about how they feel like the church has been insensitive or folks haven't reached out to them or nobody really realizes what they are going through, and they feel like a stranger here. They feel like nobody cares here. And I think sometimes we need to examine ourselves about whether we are really as aware of each other and reaching out to each other. And not just that, even if we are treating each other well, because I will tell you, sometimes we gossip and slander more about people in the church than people in the world, in our workplace or in our families. Let's be honest. 1 Corinthians chapter 6, an extreme situation of how bad it got to be among brethren, an extreme situation. Listen to the words. Maybe it's been a while since you've seen them. But imagine if Paul was speaking this. Imagine the horror in his voice. Does any one of you, when he has a case against his neighbor, dare to go to law before the unrighteous and not before the saints? Let me stop right here. something's gone so screwy among brethren that there is a legally actionable case between brethren. We're talking a civil lawsuit here, folks, between fellow Christians in the congregation. Something's gone wrong. Maybe somebody borrowed money from somebody, didn't pay it back. Maybe they were business partners, and one felt the other had defrauded them or taken more than his fair share of the business when he left. Maybe stole the Rolodex of all the customer contacts or something. And so there's money involved. And so here's Paul. He's horrified because in Corinth, you literally had brethren from the congregation suing each other down at the Harris County Courthouse. Do you, first of all, he says, don't you know that the saints will judge the world? If the world is to be judged by you, are you not competent to constitute the smallest of law courts? In other words, first of all, don't you understand the glory that we're going to be raised to in the last day? We of all people ought to know right and wrong and be able to grant justice. Can we not solve this among ourselves, first of all? Let's go to the elders instead of to the county judge. Let's go to a wise and respected brother in the congregation instead of going to the lawyers. What in the world are we doing when we get the world involved in something that we of all people who know truth and righteousness and justice, or at least we claim to as Christians, ought to be able to figure it out and set it right? Don't you know we're going to judge angels? How much more matters of this life, Paul asks. So if you have law courts dealing with matters of this life, do you appoint them as judges who are of no count in the church? These people don't even share our values. Maybe the law will be right, maybe the law will be wrong. Maybe the judge will get it right, maybe the judge will get it wrong. But he doesn't even share your values. How do you know for sure? But look at what he says next. I say this to your shame. Is it so that there is not among you one wise man who will be able to decide between the brethren? But brother instead goes to law with brother, and that before unbelievers. Listen to what he says next. Final three verses here. Actually, then it's already a defeat for you that you have lawsuits with one another. First of all, something's already gone really, really wrong if two brothers have gotten so crosswise with each other that one has a legal case against each other in the first place. Something's gone wrong. Something's run off the rails. If things have ever devolved to that point in the first place. First of all, it's a defeat right there, Paul says. But then he goes a step further. Why not rather be wronged? Why not rather be defrauded? Maybe for the church's reputation in the community, if you're on the receiving end of an injustice, maybe Paul says to the one who thinks he's innocent and been defrauded, maybe for the sake of the church's reputation in the community, for the brother's own reputation, the potential reclamation, maybe you just let it go because, you know, your rights aren't the highest thing in life. And boy, is that hard to hear, isn't it? That you can be legally and technically right and spiritually wrong in what you do and how you do it. Just because it's legal doesn't mean it's right. Just because you have a legitimate legal claim doesn't mean you should. On the contrary, you yourselves wrong and defraud. And you do this even to brethren. Shame on you. Shame on the brother who's created this situation. Shame on the other brother who has to have his rights to the detriment of the church's reputation in the entire community. Shame on everybody. Folks, we need to examine ourselves in light of our relationship with our brethren. Listen, I thanks be to God, I know of nothing like this here, obviously. But to see how bad it can get reminds us that we need to be weeding the garden all along. That's Paul's point. Shame on you that they ever got to this point in the first place. And again, let's be honest. We are not as closely connected as we should. And let's be honest, too. Sometimes the greatest wounds we receive are from brethren, not from strangers in the world. Because we find out what people have been saying about us behind our back, talking about us instead of to us. Everybody else knows that folks think we're weak or that we're worldly, but nobody ever came and told us. Now, maybe it's because you're not correctable. Maybe, and that doesn't justify it. Don't misunderstand me this morning, but maybe part of the issue is you're not correctable. And that's why folks hesitate to come and tell you what everybody else in the room knows already. But we have got to do well. And let me put it this way this morning, not as a way of rebuke, but as of encouragement, that we've got to do better. Not because I think this church has a horrible problem with fellowship among brethren. Honestly, no, I see so much love in this congregation. But that word love has no limits. As Paul puts it in one of his other letters, abound still more, because love is never done. We can always be closer. We can always know each other better. Listen, especially in a congregation this size that is as scattered as it is right now, How much more effort do we have to take to know what's going on in each other's lives and bear the burdens where they need to be borne? Who's sick? Whose parent is sick? Who's even more than the rest? I think we're all discouraged by what's going on, but who is even more discouraged than what we would call maybe the average or discouragement right now? Who's heartbroken over what's going on around us right now and who really needs a comforting word and a hand to hold? And as David calls it so well, the present distress. Who are those people? Would you even know where to begin looking? Sometimes I think we need to examine ourselves and our relationship with our brethren, not just even because we're doing wrong to them, but because we're not doing right by them. Does that make sense? You see the difference? And so that's the challenge, and that's an area that I would just humbly suggest this morning, that we can add to our list of examining ourselves. My question for you this morning is, what would you add to the list? Maybe it's something in your own life that you know, and if you know, you can be sure God knows, that you need to be working on. Maybe your brethren even know. And someone's told you before, but you rejected it at the time. But it's still there in the back of your head, and you know you need to examine yourself. You need to test yourself. You need to make your life match the faith you confess in Jesus Christ. Maybe it's something you would add to that list from personal experience, that as a brother's keeper, not because you're going to become a busybody correcting everybody else, but out of genuine love for somebody you know is struggling, you know you need to reach out and help. You need to be part of the solution, not just part of the problem of slandering and sharing with others. Did you know that somebody has this issue? God, help us to know what we really are. And God, help us to make sure that what we really are is the growing image of Jesus Christ our Lord. I hope that you will, like me this week, spend extra time, intentional time, set apart time, dedicated time to examining yourself to see whether you're in the faith. We're going to sing a song this morning as a way of ending our time together. And that song is the opportunity perhaps of somebody here who's been examining themselves already and recognizes that their life is not right with God because they never obeyed the gospel of Jesus Christ. It's been on your mind. You've been growing. You've been studying, learning the lessons of who the Lord is and what he wants and how you respond to him and enter into his kingdom. And as you've examined yourself, you recognize that this morning is your time to take that next step of confessing his name before these witnesses, repenting of your sins, and being baptized for the forgiveness of those sins. We'd like for nothing better this morning than to help you with that spiritual need. Maybe you're here this morning, you're a child of God already, and over the course of our time here, the past 30 or 40 minutes, you have been examining yourself, and there's something that you need to get off your chest with the brethren, something you want us to help you with, pray for you with, hold you accountable about, something that you want to be known so that it can be the burden can be shared. We'd like to hear from you about that too, if that's where you're at. Why don't you come talk to us right now as we stand, as we sing.